Expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. And I'm talking today with the editor of The Nation magazine, Katrina Vandenhoevel. Katrina Vandenhoevel is a frequent commentator on American politics on CNBC, CNN, and MSNBC. She also writes frequently about American and Russian politics. Her articles have appeared in The Washington Post, The LA Times, The New York Times, and she is the co-author of Voices of Glasnost, Interviews with Gorbachev's Reformers, and the editor of a number of anthologies, including The Nation, 1865 to 1990, The Best of the Nation, selections from the Independent Magazine of Politics and Culture, and most recently she edited the collection A Just Response, The Nation on Terrorism, Democracy, and September 11th, 2001. Welcome to Media Matters, Katrina Vandenhoevel.
Thank you, Bob.
It's really a pleasure to have you here, and I think a lot of our listeners are familiar with The Nation, but some of them might not be. So just for starters, why don't you talk about The Nation and its history, its circulation, to give our listeners a sense of what it's all about.
Okay. Let me begin with the present. The Nation is a muckraking, dissenting, troublemaking independent magazine of politics and culture that relishes taking on the official line. We traffic in ideas, not hype. We take seriously the power of ideas, of conviction, of conscience. And our readers now, close to 175,000 by the end of this year, Bob.
Your circulation's 175,000?
At the end of this year.
That is absolutely, I mean, for our listeners,
it's grown, yeah.
I mean, unbelievable.
It was 87,000 maybe 10, 11 years ago. And I attribute that not to great editorial skills. We play a role, but I think it's a measure of the culture of our times and the politics of our times. It's not only Bush, but it's also, I think, frustration verging on disgust with the mainstream media, something you and our Washington correspondent John Nichols have chronicled, followed, and led, mobilized people around so brilliantly. When it comes to the media, I don't need to tell you. I mean, I think we live in this country with a kind of suffocating consensus where there are so many alternatives excluded from discussion and coverage in the mainstream press, and the corporate ownership of the news media, which we hope will be rolling back, has blurred that line between entertainment and news. And we just think at The Nation the need's acute for independent perspectives and constructive ideas and radical rethinking.
You know, I think that there is a whole coterie of independent, liberal, progressive, and left opinion publications in the United States. If The Nation is, it must be the largest in circulation, isn't it? I mean, what are the other ones that are up there?
It is the largest. I know that the progressive is, I want to say 50, 60. You may know you're there.
Yeah, I'm Matt Rothschild, editor of The Progressive, who's based in Madison, Wisconsin, has been a guest on Media Matters, and their circulation, similar to yours, has just really
it's soared boomed. In these times. Yeah,
yeah, that's right.
You know, and I think all of these, it's not just the fact that we're, you know, The Nation truly is independent. We were very critical of the Clinton administration, not for the triviality of sexual matters, but because of the policies of much, you know, of trending to the center of trending the Democratic Party to the center. But we are considered on the political spectrum in this country, you know, to the progressive left as a publication. And that, you know, that is one factor. The other factor is, you know, that how sweet it is to be independent. The Nation is an independent publication, as are many of the magazines you refer to, the Progressive, I believe. The New Republic is independent. The Weekly Standard is not. It is part of Rupert Murdoch's Murdochization empire. But that's part of something I think is important. And The Nation, many, many years ago, sponsored a conference on magazines of opinion.
Mm-hmm. I recall that.
Remember? And it was what I would call a transpartisan gathering. Mm-hmm. So you had magazines, journals of liberal, center, left, right, but sharing ideas about how to, for example, you know, change the postal rates so that you would at least have a fuller marketplace of ideas in this country.
That's right. We're talking to Katrina Vandenhuvel today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded show. We did it about 10 days before going on air, so please don't call in today. Just sit back, relax, put your feet up, enjoy yourselves. We're talking about The Nation magazine that Katrina Vandenhuvel edits, as well as we'll be going into topical issues of politics today, what's going on in the world, Eastern Europe, Iraq, and in Washington, D.C. Now, The Nation has a long, I mean, it is not a recent publication. It goes back, if I'm not mistaken, to the Civil War. Is that right?
You're absolutely right. It was founded by abolitionists, men and really men at that time who wanted to abolish slavery. And it was, as I said, founded immediately after the Civil War, the end of the Civil War. And it has retained that belief in the issue of morality as a core component of our politics. And that's one that I think has run through its pages to this day. As I said earlier, fighting for causes lost and found. In many instances, Bob, you know, I think in these recent years, you know, the magazine has had a core of consistency on issues, for example, of opposing the death penalty, of opposing the militarization of our foreign policy, of support for social justice, opposition to, you know, obviously racism, support for civil rights. Martin Luther King Jr. was our civil rights correspondent for 5-6 years. We've had an extraordinary...
I didn't know that. When was that?
61 to 65.
That's extraordinary.
And in the anthology, which I think you mentioned that, you know, I edited, and it was 125 years of the magazine. And, you know, Einstein was reporting on nuclear disarmament issues for us. We had, you know, James Agee and James Baldwin, John Dos Passos, Arthur Miller still writes for us. I.F. Stone was our Washington correspondent until the editor at that time, Frieda Kirschway, had a falling out with him, and he left the magazine, sadly. Of course, Gore Vidal is still a great beacon of clarity and wisdom and taking on the powers that be in our pages. So we've had an extraordinary history.
Well, can I ask you, have the politics changed? And I ask that because the New Republic, which has been around for not quite as long, but certainly for nearly a century at this point, its politics have changed considerably. From its, in its early days, it was similar to The Nation in tone. It's probably almost identical, if not even further to the left in some regards. And today it has certainly become a centrist publication. It's much more mainstream, at times even conservative, perhaps. Has The Nation gone through many changes in its history politically?
The Nation, as we know it today, in my view, was really founded in 1917 for the reason that Oswald Garrison Villard became editor at that time. In its early years, and William Grider, our national affairs editor, has written in interesting ways about this, the magazine had lobbied against child labor laws. Was in opposition to unions. It was a strange hybrid, and very much led by E.L. Godkin, the editor at that time, who was a good government muckraker, but had strange views on social issues. I mean, one decision I had to make in this last period, Bob, is, you know, the magazine has traditionally, historically been opposed to intervention.
Mm-hmm.
We did, immediately after September 11th, support proportional, qualified use of military force in Afghanistan in response to the terrorist attacks of September 11th. The Nation, of course, opposed the war against Iraq, but it was
indeed. I might add, from the very beginning.
But we could talk about that later. To go back and look at the questions we were setting out, the reporting we were doing, is to make one weep for the box we are in today, the mess we're in today, because of some of the tough questions The Nation and other similar publications had been asking were fully addressed by a media that, you know, was on bended knee to this administration. We might have had more resilience in our democracy.
Do you think the decision, looking back upon it now, following 9/11, and I know that for listeners unaware, The Nation offices are in Lower Manhattan, not far from the Twin Towers. I mean, about a mile and a half at most, I would say.
That's right.
So you're really in the shadows, virtually, of the attacks. As you look back upon those moments, those weeks following 9/11, Do you think it was the right decision you made supporting the intervention in Afghanistan? Do you think
politics and thinking in hindsight is always it's easier and more difficult at the same time. Mm-hmm. But I do think that we were very halting in our support for proportional, discriminate use of military force. But we were very quick to argue that the important issue is not to make this a war against terrorism, but to really think of this as policing, intelligence, and seeking the political roots of these problems. So we, in our own pages, began to have a debate with our own position soon after. And Richard Falk, a member of our editorial board who was very important in the pages of the magazine in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, in fact began to rethink his position in our pages. And I think that's important, whether you're on the left, right, you're top down, that you have the honesty to rethink and acknowledge that, in hindsight, there may have been a better position if only our political class and certainly those in this White House had the courage to think that leadership is something other than never having to say you're sorry, we'd be in a better position in this country.
Yeah, in fact, I should say for listeners who are interested in this subject, to go back to the months following 9/11, I read the articles by Falk and the exchange with readers. And
yeah.
What was striking to me about it was the really high level of discussion and how it avoided a lot of the sort of political invective that sometimes gets into these debates and the egos. And really, like you said, Fox changed his position, and it was really political dialogue at its best, I thought. I was really impressed by it.
Yeah, I think you're right, because too often I think the debates do not operate on that level. And I think we're all poorer and diminished for that, because there are real issues that we, progressive community, the left, would benefit from debating in our own community and extending it out and showing the differences, but principled ones, not personal.
We're talking to Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor of The Nation magazine today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. This is a pre-recorded show done approximately 10 days before we went on air, so please don't call in today. Sit back, listen, enjoy yourself, and let us do all the yakking for you. But one last thing on The Nation, Katrina, before we move on and talk about politics. I mean, we've talked in terms of The Nation having a specific editorial policy. And I think for people who read it, they'll understand that this is somewhat misleading. But for listeners unfamiliar with The Nation magazine at present, it really covers, when we talk about the left, what would be a pretty wide range from Democrats, not even the left wing of the Democratic Party, out to people who would consider themselves Greens or socialist, radical.
Anarchists. Yeah, there's a range, absolutely. I mean, this is, I think, a political position, but, Barbara Kingsolver, Back to the Land, and an issue a few weeks ago. But, no, we do try to span and have a range of voices. Our lead editorials will try and, marshal a position every week on certain issues. This week we have one on Howard Dean opting out of the public financing system.
What's your position on that?
Well, I think the system is broken. And that, what's important in many ways is that he, in opting out, was willing to come forth with a fairly decent proposal, including a 5-to-1 public funding match and the first $100 in every contribution to presidential and congressional candidates. What's interesting about it, Bob, is that it has this opting out, and the way Dean did it is savvy, as he has done in using the internet and email to kind of lay out this grassroots engagement with his campaign. But he is going for small donors in a way that Jesse Jackson and Jerry Brown did in 88 and 92, respectively.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting to us is how people like Al Fromm, who's chair of the Corporate-Oriented Democratic Leadership Council, are grumbling that these small donors, Dean's base, may tilt the party leftward. And what I found interesting, and I'll stop, I mean, I just thought last August there was an interesting column in which it was reported that Clinton Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin reportedly told Dean that, quote, "I can't sell you on Wall Street unless Dean reconsidered his position on trade." and that was left there. And Dean now, you know, is, as you can see, as we see in these last days with the endorsements he's received from two major labor unions, SEIU and AFSCME, he's gotten traction with important constituents and members of the progressive labor community.
Well, let's just carry on with this for a second and stay with the Democrats in the presidential race. First of all, let's just, before we go to the Democrats, let's talk about their likely opponent. It's been conventional wisdom until the last few months that George W. Bush would probably get re-election fairly handily, especially coming off the mission accomplished performance in May.
Well, which he now disowns, as you know. Right? He blames those on the carrier for having pushed him into standing underneath such a banner.
Yes, in keeping with his standard pattern of accountability. And then the economy was doing poorly, so the notion was between the war and the economy, he would be susceptible to a tougher race and be given a harder challenge in 2004. And now with the recent word that the economy is turning upwards, conventional wisdom is again returning to the idea that George W. Bush is going to be a likely victor in re-election, or election, depending how one puts it, in 2004. What's your sense of things, Katrina Vandenberg?
Well, first of all, I take issue with this view that the economy is on the uptick. You know, you read these headlines like, Bloom is on the economy, and you look at the statistics, you know, it's a weak rebound in light of these obscene tax cuts and the short-term stimulus, and also the jobless rates, you know, it's very weak increase in jobs. So if if the elite wants to argue that the economy is on the upturn, I think, you know, people are going to take issue with that as their lives don't reflect this conventional wisdom. And also the healthcare issue, which is so inextricably linked to the economy, is one that this administration has done nothing on. It's worsened it. So, I mean, my view is that Bush's chickens are coming home to roost. I mean, you have stunning deficits. You have a mess of this administration's own making, with some Democratic complicity in Iraq, missing weapons of mass destructions, a newly skeptical media, not as skeptical as it should be, as, you know, state budget crises, I know, in Wisconsin, and loss of jobs, the exportation of high-tech middle-class jobs, the decimation of the industrial heartland of this country. And then you got these crazy right-wingers who really define the Republican Party, like Tom DeLay. So I think Bush's numbers, they're now around 48% reelect.
Mm-hmm. So no, explain that to our listeners. This is sort of inside talk.
Well, if he's placed up against a generic Democrat, he's at 48%, I think. And mm-hmm. I mean, people, you know, also important polling items like, you know, do you think the country's heading in the right direction? Do you think Bush is handling Iraq in the right way? Those are tumbling, those numbers. And also tumbling is this view, as Bush has laid out, that Iraq is, you know, the battlefield of the central battlefield in the war against terror. Only one in seven Americans believe that at this point. And in fact, all of the things that I know you were talking about, Bob, that the nation was writing about, so sadly, tragically, have come now to pass. I mean, what he's done, this administration, one, neoconned us into war, and two, made Iraq.
Oh, I like, is that your verb, or did you?
I thought of this the other day. I mean, I just think neoconned us into war, because I think, you know, the hijacking of our foreign policy by the small cabal of neocons is a story that is beginning to be told, but has yet to be told. And, you know, what's funny and ironic is that the left, progressives, you know, always felt containment was our foreign policy stance before this kind of regime change rollback triumphed with these neocons, that containment was fairly conservative and that we could do better with, you know, human rights and alliances of different sorts. But now containment is something to restore before we ever move on to a larger global agenda in terms of this, you know, of this administration. But I do think one thing that's interesting, and I'll stop, is the mess in Iraq has made multilateralism now, and that's, you know, a big word. It's sort of it's a strange, you know, but multilateralism, alliances, treaties, once again Everyone's a multilateralist. Every Democratic candidate speaks of the UN as an institution we should support and work with. Everyone's talking about the need for alliances and how isolated we are and how this go-it-alone cowboy policy has so undermined the security of the United States. And finally, that Iraq in so many ways was a diversion from the real fight that we need to undertake.
Summarize your view, then. You see the Iraq war as not necessarily something that's going to help President Bush.
I think it will not help him. Now, that's why, you know, they're scrambling in these last hours and in the coming week or two to find a way to do, you know, Iraqification light. That's why Paul Bremer gets called back to Washington, D.C., and all this, you know, all of this attempt now to move more quickly in Iraq to turn sovereignty over to the Iraqi people, a position I think we would agree with. But our values are very different than this administration, which may want a kind of window dressing sovereignty. I mean, we should bring Halliburton back, too, as our columnist Naomi Klein wrote in our last issue.
And she's also written, if I can interject, Naomi Klein's been writing widely about the privatization of Iraq's resources and how this violates international law.
Violates international law, which this administration has done, as we know, without a second thought in terms of going into this war. But yeah, it's very important. And I mean, you know, I think that resonates with the American people. The sticker shock of that $87 billion, reconstruction rebuilding, bill a couple weeks ago. And also now you see reports which should be more widely disseminated that, you know, big contributors to the Bush administration, Bush campaign are those truly benefiting from the selling off of Iraq.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Katrina VandenHeuvel today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. You're listening to AM 580 WILL in Urbana, Illinois. We're talking with Katrina VandenHeuvel about The Nation, the magazine she edits out of New York, and also about politics, which is the stuff of The Nation, national and international. We've been talking about the 2004 presidential race and President Bush's chances or prospects of reelection. Let's turn to the Democrats now. The Nation, I think, more than any publication in the country covers Democratic politics. John Nichols, one of your star correspondents, covering electoral politics almost on a issue-by-issue basis in great detail. And I think probably The Nation covers it more than any medium in the country, certainly focusing on the issues of concerns to Democrats or to liberals or to progressives. What is your sense? We've got, I think, 9 candidates now in the Democratic field. What is your sense of the caliber of candidates out there for voters to look at?
Well, first of all, I dislike, I don't know how you feel, Bob, the mainstream media sort of trashing the field as a baseball team. There are too many out there. I mean, that the field is diminished by 9 candidates. I mean, let's not forget Bush in 1999, already diminished in these he was debating Steve Forbes and Gary Bauer. He was no great shakes, and suddenly, you know, he emerges. But more important, you know, from the perspective of The Nation, there are several candidates who are of great interest to us. And Howard Dean, Dennis Kucinich, and to a certain extent, Gephardt, are candidates of interest to this community.
Gephardt, that's interesting. Why is that?
Well, at the Gephardt, because of his support among labor, because of the trade issue, which has been, you know, a central one in the pages of the magazine, the debates around globalization, and mm-hmm. You know, that we've been a forum for those who understand that, you know, there's a corporate-centered globalization and a people-centered globalization, that what's important in the 21st century is, you know, not that globalization's going away, but, you know, by whom, for whom. So, but Gephardt to a certain extent, but Dean and Kucinich are the ones who have attracted the attention of our readers, and that's why, you know, I asked John a few weeks ago to do a piece about sort of laying out where's Dean, where's Kucinich in terms of issues, and why is it that in the left progressive community, where Dennis Kucinich, no question about it, has all the values that the magazine, The Nation, has stood by in these last years. Why is it that Dean has gained so much traction?
It's a very interesting question. One thing that comes to mind is if our listeners were unfamiliar with the race or hadn't been following it, and they'd only been reading the New York Times or Time Magazine or Newsweek or watching the press coverage or the TV coverage in the national cable news networks, they might not even be aware Kucinich was running.
You know, I think that's right, Bob. And, you know, I was talking to Dennis Kucinich maybe once a week before he announced, or no, before he entered, because he announced so much later. And I would ask him why he wasn't getting in sooner. And some of it was he needed to finish work in Congress. Some of it, of course, was he was resolving his position on choice. But I worried that he would lose his position as the true anti-war candidate, which Dean really, you know, wasn't. He's made it his mantle. But Dean was known more as Dr. Dean. The healthcare issue was his. But Dennis waited to come in, and I don't know if that made any difference in what I think you're referring to as the kind of marginalization that we see in the media. We see it in the debates where he gets less time. We see it in the treatment of Dennis in the mainstream media, though I think there's a grudging respect, which if you can read but between the lines, for Dennis's clarity, which he brings to these debates, where some of the candidates, for example, around the issue of ending the occupation now are more convoluted. Dennis has a clarity, whether you agree with him or not, and he says what he believes. He says it, and you know, he was out there. I mean, he was out there. You know, this is what frustrates me. I mean, we look at what we've been writing and arguing, for example, on, you know, the issue of invading Iraq. We were out there. Everyone now, as you know, Bob, you know, says Bush lied, you know, where were the weapons of mass destruction, calling for Rumsfeld's resignation. I mean, these were things we were doing months and months ago. And with Dennis, he must feel the same way in a very different capacity as a congressional leader, but fighting hard, fighting, leading the fights against the administration, whether on the war or the Patriot Act. So,
do you think Dennis Kucinich, if he got the nomination, which I think is a fairly hypothetical question, assuming somehow he'd won the Democratic Party's nomination, do you think with his viewpoints, which are, in fact, I think you're right, almost identical to the nation's editorial page, do you think he could win a national election in the United States?
Well, this is, let me answer and evade your question at the same time.
I couldn't answer it either.
Yeah, so I mean, what John Nichols in his good reporting piece for us came up with in terms of the traction Dean is getting is the pragmatism that is so infusing the progressive community this electoral season for good reason. I think, you know, as a Nobel economist said a few months ago, this is the worst administration this country has ever had. It is a looting administration. It's looting our country and our future. And people feel that what's crucial is, yes, we build for the long term, but in the short term, unless we get Bush out of the White House, we are in for a very bad period, worse than we've seen in these last few years. So I think the feeling is Dennis hasn't gained the traction leading into the primaries, let alone so the question has not arisen as to whether he could even win the general. I hate the fact that we've had to lower our sights. And I think it's a danger for the progressive community to lose sight of the larger values we should continue to fight for. But the electability pragmatism argument is a very compelling one.
Yeah, what's sort of somewhat ironic is that Dean's appeal, it seems to me, to many progressives or people who would see themselves in the left wing of the Democratic Party, is the fact that he is to be, I don't know if this is the right word to use, but opportunistic, maybe in the best sense of the term, depending on how you look at it, in the sense of trying to find the issues that will work. And, you know, his reputation, his record as governor of Vermont was that of a moderate Democrat.
Yes, absolutely.
Maybe even a conservative Democrat by Northeastern standards.
He was certainly, you know, he's certainly a fiscal conservative, and he is someone who's tilted toward corporate interests at various times. But, you know, I think what's important to look at, it seems to me, is the Howard Dean phenomenon, that we focus on Dean rather than on the phenomenon, which is that there is, a royal group of voters looking for someone who will stand up to this administration physically. I mean, you know how Dean positions himself? There's this kind of, you know, I'm ready to fight. Now, how that goes down in a general is an open question. I truly dislike the mainstream media saying Dean isn't electable. I mean, that's where we're at, right? The way they cover him as angry, no solutions. But I think that's what's important to look at. That there is a passion to unseat Bush, and he stepped into it. And then, of course, he's been very savvy with an important tool in our new electoral landscape, which I don't need to tell you about, but the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
He's harnessed that effectively, and he seems to have a team which understands that you're going to bring in not only younger people, but all kinds of people, and then you have the Move On, the great, you know, the great successful Internet organization mobilizing people around issues against the war, against Bush now, having held its virtual primary, which, again, was a coup for him to win, though Dennis, of course, came in second.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Katrina Vandenhoevel today in Media Matters. This is a pre-recorded show, so please don't call in. To make a call, let Katrina Vandenhoevel, the editor of The Nation, and me, Bob McChesney, do the talking for you today, which will be our pleasure. Not too much hard work for either of us. Your sense is that Dean is really at this stage, and we're still a couple months away from the first formal register of people sentiment.
That's right.
But right now he's sitting in a pretty good position, as you see it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was talking to David Korn, our Washington editor, the other day, whose book, by the way, Bush's Lies, or forget the exact title, he'll kill me, is doing so well. But he was saying that in you know, looking back in these last years, the candidate who comes in, I fear, into our money-drenched political system with the most money is, in history's terms, the one who wins.
Yeah, I think since 1976, the person with the most money at the end, you know, the coming into the year, always wins the nomination.
So it may be very hard to for those, whether in the Democratic establishment or those on the left, who think Dean is, you know, there's a great gap between his rhetoric and his record, to stop him. And so it'll be interesting to watch. Of course, he, you know, has a shoot from the hip quality, but it seems like every time he says something, like, you know, I think what he said about, you know, he wanted to be the candidate for guys with Confederate flags in their pickup trucks was wrong and stupid. But he says these things, and then, you know what, he has Jesse Jackson Jr. This coming week or in the next few days likely to endorse him in these two major progressive labor organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something going on here in this phenomenon, which is kind of like, you know, it's like an anti-ideological phenomenon, but combines the anger, the passion, and the desire to beat Bush.
And I think, yeah, the part of the appeal is Dean looks like he knows how to run a campaign.
Exactly. I think that's what won him the big labor endorsements. They,
mm-hmm.
I mean, if there's anyone who looks for electability, it's the man who anointed Bill Clinton, Gerald McEntee, the head of AFSCME, who really, you know, looked carefully at Dean's grassroots outreach as well as what he'd been doing with his team, his organization. I think there were site visits by AFSCME
mm-hmm.
to Dean's Vermont office. And what they saw with Kerry and Gephardt, they didn't like. Now, to be fair, not stop being insider baseball here, but Gephardt is 7 points ahead in the polls in Iowa as of a few days ago. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, we'll see. We'll see. People haven't voted yet. That's what's so crazy.
That's right. We're 2 months out. We're talking in terms of money and organization.
I know. I mean, well, money, as you know, in this, I mean, that's why we concluded our edit with Dean is, you know, it's important what he's calling for. In some ways more important at this moment than how he's operating in a system that's broken, that is not a level playing field, with Bush Inc. likely to raise $200 million, no opponent, of course, but that these candidates should be held to a set of issues that progressives believe in, whether it's, you know, public financing in a real way or, for example, instant runoff voting that could lead in the future to the possibility of a third party that wouldn't be a spoiler party in this country. But maybe Dennis Kucinich can play an important role in that regard by playing, you know, pushing the Democratic platform, even if it's not adhered to in serious ways, but really pushing to have those issues he cares for, that progressives care for, that decent people care for, heard inside the Democratic Party.
In 2000, one of the big debates in the pages of The Nation, which reflected, I think, a major debate in the liberal progressive left community in the United States, concerned Ralph Nader and the Green Party candidacy for president. And I know that your writers and editors were split on this issue. There was a divergence of opinion whether to support Nader or to support Gore. And in 2004, do you see that as emerging as an issue again at The Nation?
You know, let me answer that in two ways. More important, it seems to me, Bob, and, you know, you were interviewed for Mika Sifri's recent piece called Ralph Redux, which is subtitled Not Only Democrats But Many Greens Oppose a Nader Run in 2004. There are many of the Greens doing the most successful work in the United States today are worried about what a Nader run could mean for the future long-term success of the Green Party in terms of building capacity, building its infrastructure. To me, I think that's very telling. And then you have people like Ronnie Duggar, who wrote a piece for us a few months ago. Ronnie was one of five people who nominated Ralph Nader at the Green Party conference a few years ago, saying, Ralph, don't run. It's not his moment. Or as Michael Moore, I heard, said to Ralph Nader, it's not your room this year, Ralph. And Michael Moore knows rooms and knows how to play to rooms. So I think that debate, even for people like Mika Sifri, who's a real believer and an articulator of third parties and their value in American democracy, is one that we won't see replayed in the same way. I went back and looked at some of our coverage in 2000, Bob, and I saw that we had asked Eric Alterman to write a piece called Bush versus Gore, What Are the Differences?
I remember it well.
Yeah, and to lay it out, because as you know, it was Bush versus Gore, I think so many people felt. And, you know, I don't think people can say that now. The differences on too many issues are clearly defined.
We're talking to Katrina Vandenhoevel today on Media Matters. This is a pre-recorded show, so please don't call in. Katrina Vandenhoevel is the editor of The Nation magazine, the largest liberal progressive left publication in the United States, with a circulation rapidly approaching 175,000, did you say?
At the end of the year, that's what we're looking at.
Wow. And once again, for our listeners, I've been involved in independent publishing for two decades in one form or another. If someone had told me a decade ago or 15 years ago that The Nation would be looking at circulation totals like that, I would figure we would have a very different politics in this country.
Well, that's our goal. We're going to...
Yeah, I guess The Nation circulation comes first and the politics follows.
But I do think, you know, I do think, Bob, we have a different politics. We had just briefly something John Nichols and I talk a lot about, but to look at what's happening beneath the media, national media radar, and some of the victories across the country, you know, on living wages and public financing of elections in the states, banning sweatshop produced goods and providing universal health care, you know, importing drugs from Canada to counter big pharma. These are battles that are not the big battles, but they're important, and they show some victories. And I think this country is, we've talked about this, is a more progressive country than how we're represented, and that speaks to the possibilities.
Well, one of the concerns in that area is that the country is split geographically.
Yeah, yeah.
That, we go into the 2004 election, not just to pick on the election, because it holds for much broader discussion than just a presidential election. And, you know, we already know that there are 25 states that will certainly go for Bush, barring calamity, and 20 states or so that will certainly go for the Democrat, barring calamity. And we're down really to a handful of what literally and figuratively are border states that will determine the outcome of the election. Because it is, you know, the country is very different in some ways.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there are major Democratic mobilizations for this presidential year. As you said, you know, there are certain states not in play. And, you know, GOP gubernatorial candidates won the state houses in Kentucky and Mississippi just a couple weeks ago. But I don't know if the implications of these races for 2004 are that clear. I think you still have the industrial heartland, and that's where major mobilization is going on outside the Democratic Party because of McCain-Feingold.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, John Nichols has written a lot about this. You know, rural Americans are even more concerned than urban voters about access to health care, education, and job loss.
Yeah. Yeah.
Under Bush. So I think you need to pop up the populist economic volume, and that may be a way of countering the cynical and divisive tactics of the Southern Republican right, but the country is 50-50. But heartening, I have to say, is that independent, you know, one wants to have massive get-out-the-vote, massive voter registration. There are efforts underway both, you know, led by Jesse Jackson Jr., all kinds of different groups, labor unions. But I think the independent vote, which is showing a swing away from Bush, is heartening.
We're talking to Katrina VandenHeuvel today in Media Matters, and I have selfishly been talking a lot about electoral politics because it's a personal passion of mine. I think now let's turn away, if we can, and talk about an area where, Katrina, you've got great expertise, which is European politics, especially Eastern European politics in Russia. And, you know, this is an area of the world that, you know, for someone, I'm 50 years old, someone growing up in this country in the post-war years, we were inundated with images of Eastern Europe. It was covered, I think, not especially well, but all Americans were familiar with the Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc, the Warsaw Pact. It was a defining feature of our experience. Yet in the last 10 years, it's virtually fallen off the map. I mean, almost, I mean, I have kids in college too. I have to show them a Rambo movie to remind them about the Cold War.
Yeah, I have a 12-year-old daughter. I mean, she's been to Moscow 30 times, but she doesn't, she sees a very different Moscow. You know, but what's, just to go back to the fight against terrorism and the nuclear security issue, it's frightening, Bob, but, you know, Russia is a Walmart of loose nukes, and the funding that's needed to really address that problem is not huge, but it has been cut because of Iraq or, you know, where what, the, you know, it's just
what
insane.
Would that funding go to, Katrina? I mean, what is the money needed for?
It's needed to clean up and to decommission nuclear weapons. The security in Russia is appalling, partly because of the poverty and the unpaid scientists, unpaid security workers around nuclear reactors, around nuclear labs. So all of that, which is part of what they called Nunn-Lugar, Senators Nunn and Senators Lugar sponsored this bill. It was an important and not huge in terms of the money that could have been expended and now has been
especially
cut.
Considering the stakes.
Especially considering the stakes. And the other frightening thing, and this is, you know, how you convey this to students, you may want to show Putin giving, the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, giving a speech in which he says that they're going to start building up their nuclear arsenals because of the United States' new nuclear security doctrine, which, you know, is part of the whole Bush doctrine. I mean, between preemptive war, which basically leads countries to want to acquire nuclear weapons more quickly, and Bush building up nuclear arsenals instead of building down, Russia is following that lead for the moment. So that's frightening that you have this, you know, takes two to tango dynamic.
Yeah, well, let's go back to 1989, or really the Gorbachev years in the mid to late 1980s, and then the demise and fall of the communist rule in the Soviet Union. At that time, there was a lot of euphoria, I think, I don't know about Eastern Europe, but certainly in the West and in the United States, that this was going to lead to representative democracies and growing, booming free market economies that would take advantage of the extraordinary human capital of Eastern Europe. And the story sort of fell from view. I mean, we sort of fell off the map around 1991. What has happened in Russia specifically in the last 10 or 12 years? How has the transition gone?
It's tragic, Bob. You know, Mikhail Gorbachev did try to sort of, you know, reform Russians, to reform socialism. He's a social democrat. But that fell apart because of the coup, which your listeners may recall in 91, which brought Boris Yeltsin into full power, and then you had the, as my, you know, some my Russian friends call it, the abolition of the Soviet Union, because there was a treaty signed in a forest with a lot of drunk people, which abolished the Soviet Union. You then had a process of radical privatization, or piratization, as it's been called, which was the greatest fire sale looting of any country in modern history. You had what are called oligarchs, basically stealing the natural resources, oil, gas, the minerals of this great land, because they were in the right place at the right time, they were well connected, they were not, quote, free market reformers, and Yeltsin was complicit in that. So what we're seeing, if your listeners have followed the story in the pages in these last weeks, of the arrest of one of the leading oligarchs, a man named Mikhail Khodorkovsky, valued personally at $8 billion, his company, Yukos, one of the largest oil companies in Russia, and Russia, I believe, after Saudi Arabia, one of the largest oil-producing nations, is really the beginning of the possibility of de-Yeltsinization, which might mean that you would see a new economic course. Now, should Khodorkovsky be in prison? No, I mean the courts or other ways of taxing, of seizing back some of this oligarchical money that could be invested in a Russia that has gone through one of the great depressions in these last 10 years, a story that has barely been reported in this country.
Let's report on that for a second here, because as I recall, by the mid-90s, the Russian GDP per capita had fallen almost by 50%. I think historically unprecedented drop.
Unprecedented. The state statistics show something like, you know, one-third of the country living in poverty, another quarter just on the subsistence level. The human toll is a spread of disease with the public health system collapsing, premature deaths, the mortality rate.
What's the average lifespan
for men? I believe it's something like 56, Bob. Can
Unbelievable.
You imagine? Isn't that?
Because wasn't it in the 70s?
Yeah.
Generation?
No, you hear reports if you're in Moscow. Now, you don't hear this as much in Moscow, which is and has been in Russian history the wealthiest city in that vast land. But in the provinces, in the countryside, people will literally say Russia is dying because of the population shrinking by nearly a million people a year.
Is this emigration or just death?
No, it's
just people dying.
Births. The birth rate is low, and that's always a measure, to some extent, of people's hopes for the future, people's despair for the future. So, you know, it's a very difficult picture. And there has been very little democracy in Russia since 91. The attack on an elected parliament in 1993, which was acclaimed in too much of the West, including the United States, by the Clinton administration. You know, you have attack on free press. One could make a very strong case that the press was freer in 1990 than it is today. Mm-hmm. You see, Bob, lots of what you and John write about the control of the media by, you know, vast oligarchical interests pursuing their own political agendas with no regulation. So it's a complex picture. Where it heads, many in the West, many in the mainstream press see this as an attack on, you know, Khodorkovsky because he got involved in politics. I think that's just a very small part of the explanation, because the political system in Russia, sadly, is rigged. I was there in June and July. The idea of clean elections, the fact that the Kremlin couldn't jigger a few points here and there to get the political parties they want in the parliament or get Putin reelected, that's just a given. But one last thing which is interesting is that the Communist Party, which, you know, so frightened this country, right? I mean, it was different because it had a monopoly on power. Very important to delineate Gorbachev's Communist Party from what preceded, but also important to understand that today the Communist Party is the largest, best-organized political party in Russia, and it's going to probably receive most of the votes in the parliamentary, at 26-27% in the parliamentary elections to be held on December 7th.
Now, what are the Communist Party's current political views? I doubt they're calling for a return to Bolshevism.
It's mixed. There's a younger generation in the Communist Party which is there because it feels that Russia's been impoverished, that, you know, oligarchs have made out with the country's wealth, and they want to see a level playing field. But there's an older generation of communists, including the leader. They talk social justice. They're too complicit with Putin. And they also, I fear, have a streak of Russian nationalism and a measure of anti-Semitism, which is disturbing to see in a party that was supposed to be sort of the international cosmopolitan party. It is quite striking to go into a leading communist office and see Orthodox Russian, you know, church symbols.
Yeah.
It's a different communist party than we grew up with.
That's really, I mean, when you talk about what has happened in terms of the corruption in the Soviet Union, or former Soviet Union, Russia, the corruption and the decline in living standards, the collapse of the economy, sort of the collapse of any sort of civic integrity. You know, if you look historically at countries that have gone through that, especially once powerful countries, and I the country that immediately comes to mind is Germany in the late 20s and early 30s. I mean, these are usually social crises that lend themselves to horrible outcomes in terms of, you know, bigotry, nationalism.
The rise of anti-Semitism is also disturbing, because what's happened in Russia is that most of the oligarchs are Jewish. Mm-hmm. And in fact, several of them in these last days, involved with Yukos, the oil company under fire, went to Israel, where because several of the leading executives had dual citizenship. But you know that you know why that's fanned and fueled? Because of the poverty in the country, mm-hmm. and the resentment and frustration you talk about. You know, Weimar Germany, there are always analogies made to the contemporary Russian scene. One hopes for, though, a younger generation that will have some measure of identity, of a great state that isn't fueled by militarism or excessive nationalism. And there are pockets. I mean, I've been involved with the women's movement for years, Bob, in Russia. Mm-hmm. And there's some very entrepreneurial, idealistic, wonderful, well-organized people who are beginning to find resources in their own country to develop, however small, but still, you know, networks working on everything from domestic abuse to women in business to women in politics. And that's more hopeful. One thing we can't ignore is, you know, that the fact that the oligarchs have, you know, protected themselves and whitewashed their image through the press in this country, and also, by the way, by funding conservative think tanks in Washington.
Really?
Oh, yeah, there's a story there that's worth funding.
Like a good story for the nation.
Yep, and also, you know, Hodorkovsky had a foundation which gave enormous amounts to the Library of Congress, and the Librarian of Congress, James Billington, had a big ceremony with him. So, you know, this is trans. I mean, we should look at the corruption in Russia and judge it from our perspective, but never ignore that corruption is globalized, as we know, mm-hmm. and that there are links, mm-hmm. and that you need the complicity of a country like the United States to fuel some of what we've seen in Russia.
Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor of The Nation, we've only got about a minute left, and in the last minute, I'd love it if you just give our listeners a sense of what you read to stay on top of the news. What's your media diet look like?
Oh, I read a lot of, I begin, you know, with the basics. I mean, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, but I'll read everything on the Internet.
Everything?
Everything that I can. Mm-hmm. I read The Economist. I read all of the magazines of opinion. Left, right, center.
What's your favorite conservative publication? What's the one if you could only pick one that you had to take with you, which would it be, do you think?
I don't know if I have a favorite. I read them to get my blood boiling, and I read them to understand that I don't have a favorite, I have to say. I pick and choose. I mean, I'll read the Weekly Standard, and I'll read the National Review. But, you know, then you read the Drudge Report. There is a different sensibility, obviously, to publications on the Internet. So much of it is more mobilization.
Katrina Vandenhoevel, I'm afraid our time is drawn to an end. It's been a wonderful pleasure to have Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor of The Nation, with us in Media Matters today. And I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We'll be back 1 week from today with another guest. Thank you for listening, and goodbye, Katrina.
Thank you, Bob. Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Mall in Urbana. Every Saturday morning, starting at 9 a.m. from now through December 27th, Lincoln Square is hosting the Market in the Square with homegrown seasonal produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, showers and thunderstorms developing, windy with a high in the mid-60s, temperature falling into the upper 40s late. South winds 20 to 30 miles per hour with gusts to around 40 miles per hour, turning west late. Tonight, a chance of rain and snow, then a chance of snow after midnight, breezy and much cooler with the low in the upper 20s and northwest winds 20 to 25 miles per hour, gusting to around 45 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 2 p.m. Central Time, a Prairie Home Companion.